Sky News Centre at 5. Detectives have more clues in the week-long hunt for fugitive Raoul Moat. They found three mobile phones used by the man they want in connection with three shootings. They've also arrested a man and a woman in Northumberland on suspicion of assisting an offender. Temporary Chief Constable Sue Sim held a public meeting in Rothbury last night and is now meeting local neighbourhood officers.
I told you last night and I tell the communities it's really, really important that I'm here to listen to their point of views. And I'm here to reassure them with my staff. I'm here to talk to my staff to find out how things are going.
The RAF has again been helping in the search for Raoul Moat. This afternoon, a tornado jet has been flying over the Rothbury area. In other news, the 10 members of a Russian spy ring have arrived in Moscow after they were deported from the US. The group was swapped on the tarmac at Vienna Airport for four Western spies jailed in the former Soviet Union. A boy of 15 has been jailed for at least 23 years for murdering his ex-girlfriend and her older sister in a house fire in London. Akmal Mir poured petrol through the letterbox because he'd been dumped. Many of us are in for an uncomfortable night. A health alert's been issued for East Anglia and South East England, warning children and the elderly could suffer in sweltering temperatures. Meanwhile, a hosepipe ban's in force in North West England. John Butcher from water company United Utilities says that's despite last year's floods.
All the reservoirs filled to the point of overflow, so we couldn't have stored another drop of water. But since those floods, during December, right the way through to where we are here in July, we've only seen 50% of the expected rainfall.
In sport, Mark Webber's recorded the quickest time in second practice for the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. The Red Bull driver set the pace ahead of Ferrari's Fernando Alonso. The race is on Sunday. And Cheryl Cole's left intensive care and has been transferred to a private clinic. The singer's been battling the potentially deadly disease malaria, which she caught while on a trip to Tanzania. She spent 6 days there last month. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling and my guest to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Lib Dem councillor for Knowle and cabinet member for community safety, Gary Hopkins. After the 6 o'clock news, this week has seen the fifth anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings back in 2005. Well, we did our own 7/7 inquiry on last week's show, so this week we focus on the precursor to that in the so-called War on Terror, the 9/11 attacks on New York. Joining us is coffee importer Ian Henshaw, who's written one of the UK's definitive books on the attacks, entitled 9/11, The New Evidence. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. And in a word, hot, averaging over 20 degrees Celsius this weekend, dry with lots of sun. Next week, temperatures going dipping a bit, down to 16 degrees Celsius, a fairly cloudy week generally, but with some sunny spells and rain at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, 17th and 18th July, again, high temperatures. Next weekend, averaging around about 20 degrees Celsius, dry again and sunny. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now. And with me is Liberal Democrat councillor for Knowle and cabinet member for community safety, Gary Hopkins. Hi, Gary, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi. One or two other things to look after as well, actually, apart from community safety.
Okay. Well, let's just start with community safety. Yep. What is community safety?
The council's job is obviously liaising with the police. In terms of helping to tackle crime, helping to reduce crime, designing out crime, and also working with the public so that they get involved and that they actually feel safe as well as being safe.
Okay, so what else is part of your portfolio then, other than
transport, waste, and also two or three jobs that I've taken on this year where services within the council which have, shall we say, been struggling and that need some fairly radical change.
Now that's a lot for one person to take on, isn't it? Don't you think you should be sharing these responsibilities around a little bit? Because there's only a few of you really in the Lib Dem cabinet and there's lots and lots of councillors. We've got something like 80 councillors, haven't we?
We have 70 councillors in Bristol, 38 of them are actually Liberal Democrats. The system that we work under here is actually a cabinet system as introduced by the previous government. And it has advantages and disadvantages, so that 8 cabinet members, we have 2 assistants, and basically and some of the functions of the council are actually done on a cross-party basis by non-executive members like the licensing committee, that sort of thing. So we aren't doing everything between us, but I do have quite a big portfolio.
Now, community safety, is that one of these partnerships?
Yes, it's something that can't be done purely by the police. And it can't be done, obviously, purely by the council. A lot of the work that we actually do is supporting the police. A lot of it is, in actual fact, working with the police and other agencies, fire and rescue services, etc., to try and make certain that wherever somebody has a problem that affects their personal safety, they can get some assistance and that they're not going to be bounced around. So partnerships aim, if they run well, to have one point of contact and things get done.
Okay, but how does it actually work? Who comes along? You've mentioned some of those other groups, but are there other community representatives on these partnerships?
Safe for Bristol, we also have representatives from the voluntary sector. We also have reps from health, because basically there are issues there as well. Also on different parts of the council also represented, so you'll have the housing section, which is also pretty vital because people don't feel safe unless they've, you know, their home is safe. So all the different sections of the council as well.
Now, that isn't actually a council committee, is it? It's sort of peripheral to the council. Are the public allowed to come along to these meetings, and are they advertised?
The executive meetings, no, but most of the meetings that, because very often confidential stuff is actually discussed there, but most of the meetings of under the auspices of Safer Bristol, which is part of the Bristol Partnership, most of the meetings are open, and a lot of them now, in actual fact, effectively take part in the community spread around Bristol.
Okay, do you want to just tell us, because transport's a massive issue in the city, I mean, I imagine there's people there sitting in jams right now, fuming at you. Can you tell us, is there any hope on the horizon for transport in the city?
Yes. The first thing is that actually, although we don't agree on absolutely everything, we're working pretty effectively with the 3 surrounding councils, Cuba councils, councils it used to be even, and basically we have produced some results from the transport planning over the last few years. Actually, although it's still bad, congestion has actually measurably decreased over the last year by about 5%. Percentage of people who are going by bus has actually increased, despite the fact that bus fares are too high in Bristol. And the number of people actually walking and cycling has increased dramatically.
But isn't that just part and parcel of the slump, recession, whatever you want to call it?
No. That's a small factor in it, but we're, for example, increasing bus patronage against the national trend. Nationally, the patronage is actually going down. In Bristol and surrounding areas, it's actually going up. So it isn't just part of the national trend caused by the slump. And in actual fact, Bristol and the surrounding area, although we've had some effect from the recession, hasn't been hit nearly as badly as other places.
Now, many people complain in the city about the cost of travelling by bus. Why is it so high here?
We've got almost a monopoly, unfortunately, with the First Group. And if you're running a company and your primary objective is to make a profit and you're not getting any competition, you will tend to, instead of putting huge amounts of effort into increasing the percentage of people using the service, which is what we want them to do, you will put up the bus fares. Clearly, we have to try and work with First to try to talk them out of increasing the bus fares and to keep them down so that I would increase patronage. But one of the other things that we obviously are trying to do is to attract competition.
But at the end of the day, you know, all you can do is just sort of persuade them, you know, buy them a drink and ask them nicely, you know. There doesn't seem to be a lot of power for you to actually force them to reduce fares or to really provide a service which is serving the public.
No, we don't have any powers. Those were taken away by central government some years ago, so we have no power to regulate the bus fares on standard buses. If we manage to get the rapid transit system in, that will be treated more like a railway, and we would have control over that. And in actual fact, we would be able to regulate the fares on that service.
What about a strategic authority? Because that's another possibility. I mean, I know up in Yorkshire, and I travel to sometimes, they've got some kind of regional transport authority, which where the local authorities have all got together to manage the transport themselves. In fact, they run quite a lot of buses, I believe, themselves as well.
Well, although we've actually had, it would be actually illegal for us to run buses. Government prevent us doing so. We do agree with quite a lot of things with the surrounding councils, but not everything. And this is one thing we do disagree upon. All parties within Bristol are agreed that we actually want an independent transport authority. The surrounding councils don't want one.
Now, I have to mention, Gary, you were photographed recently parking your car in a bus stop. That's not very safe, is it?
I wasn't in actual fact parking my car in a bus stop. And in actual fact, I mean, I think that unfortunately shows that you shouldn't believe everything you read in the papers. When I, along with everyone else in the area, actually knows that that's not been a bus stop for 5 years, and officers actually admitted that the designation of that should have been changed quite some years ago.
I wonder if there's been people waiting there for a bus to arrive and no bus has ever come.
Well, I know sometimes there's a long gap in between, but I don't think 5 years.
Can you tell us where it is?
Yeah, that's in Cannon Street in Bedminster, but it's not the only example. And there are other examples around the city. I mean, I've only just recently taken over responsibility for transport, but I'm disappointed to find that there are areas around the city where the designation on you know, the lining and signing, etc., does not match the actual reality of what should be there.
Okay, now, here as usual is old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers too. Martin, how's the crisis at BP and the Deepwater Horizon oil spill likely to affect us financially here? Do you think petrol prices are going to go up?
Well, obviously, the implication is that they would. I've been reading some interesting stuff on the internet about the financial implications of what's happened, the possibility that BP is actually going to go belly up, a bit like Lehman Brothers. And if you think about it, an institution like BP is probably bigger than most of the money centre banks.
But would that affect
It could be a major shock to the financial system, let alone the ecosystem.
Well, let's just start at the petrol pumps. You know, would it mean that BP prices go up? And obviously everyone would then go to the other garages.
Well, I mean, the oil price is determined in futures markets. So it's very much determined by what people's expectations are about the future. One of the problems we've got is that these futures markets, these spot markets, are very, very unstable. It's not clear that supply and demand, as in supply and demand for oil, determines the price. Speculators are able to pile into these markets and push the price of oil up and down. And of course, it's very difficult for anybody planning to make anything, to make a plan in a situation where major costs like oil are constantly being changed and messed around by speculative behaviour, as well as, of course, the long-run trend for oil to run out and, you know, mess to be made, as we can see in the Gulf.
Well, what about the knock-on effect on pension funds and things like that? Is that a real threat?
What I've been reading suggests that if BP goes bankrupt, which it may do as a result of all of this, that could be a major shock to the financial system, including pension funds and all the rest of it. It's like, you know, you can imagine something of the size of BP going belly up can carry a lot of things down with it.
But they're one of the most profitable companies, if not the most profitable company, maybe after Shell or Exxon, in the world.
As long as all the externalities of their behaviour aren't costed in. I mean, the reason they might go bust is because they've got to pay compensation to all these people that have had their livelihoods destroyed and so on. And it's potentially huge. You destroy the whole Gulf of Mexico and destroy the economy of several US states, that's a lot of money.
Now, back to you, Gary. Now, potholes, this is becoming a bit of a problem. Along Passage Road and Wickbeck Road in Brentree, the A4018 there that runs up to the, just before you get into South Gloucestershire, that runs up to Cribbs Causeway, from the Downs, you know, kind of down from the Downs and then up again towards Cribbs Causeway, is in a terrible state. There's just holes all over the road. It's like a third world country.
Sorry, Gov, but not me. In actual fact, a lot of the services of this sort, that's why I'm able to cover quite a wide area, a lot of the services are dealt with through neighbourhoods now, so I don't know about a lot of the details.
As an A road, it is actually an A road, that. It's the A4018, yeah. For the nerdy amongst us. Isn't that supposed to be looked after by the Department of Transport?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's within our boundary, it's our responsibility.
Okay, well, a mystery as to why this road is just like full of holes. And the other thing is, I was talking to Councillor Ken Maddox from North Somerset, or from Somerset County Council recently, and they're doing a review into the privatisation of the police civilian support services in Avon and Somerset Police, and also, I think, is it North Somerset Council, that there's been a privatisation of part of the... part of the council, the civilian part of it, and the support services. What's your experience of this IBM contract with the police? Do you think it's working?
It's too early to know, to be quite honest. There's lots of claims that, it's going to save vast amounts of money. There's no evidence yet that it will do, but there's no conclusive evidence yet that it won't.
Because they were having some terrible problems with the computer system that IBM had installed for them. You know, the idea is that these big guys can come along and provide a state-of-the-art system, and the police are saying that they're spending hours and hours just trying to fill in these online forms. A bit like what we were hearing last week about the MPs having to fill in online forms to try and get their expenses back.
Well, I mean, I'm always rather sceptical about large computer schemes, having seen what some large private companies do, but also practically every large scheme that the government have actually got into has failed miserably somewhere along the line. I think the problem is that once it's been sold, people think, oh, that's it, we've done it, we're out of here now. And really, there needs to be more canniness from the customer in terms of making certain that the service comes along before the supplier gets paid.
Well, obviously, I mean, I agree with that. I mean, if you can't just privatise things and then say, well, that's all dealt with. You've got to supervise. It's a bit like the financial system. The view was taken that they knew what they were doing and they didn't need to be supervised, and the politicians just let them get on with it. That's no good. I mean, you've got all of these things need to be regulated properly, whether they're private or public sector.
Yes, and if you look into IBM's history, you'll find that they were rather naughty in the 1930s, supplying all these machines to the Gestapo for them to... Maybe it's a different company now, but, this is not the sort of company that, you know, you want to just award contracts to. Are you happy about the way these contracts are awarded, Gary?
I think there's an awful lot of people who drive Volkswagen cars, but I still remember where they came from. The British government over the years has done some pretty... dealt with some pretty horrendous people as well, so... I think that you have to look at what their recent history is and can they do the job.
But are you happy about the way these contracts are actually awarded? Because I think for small potential suppliers, it often seems that there's lots and lots of hoops for them to jump through, that really the massive multinationals can jump through them.
There has to be quite a lot of concern about it. I mean, the big thing that really concerned me was the PFI rip-off. Which has been an absolute disgrace.
This is the private finance initiatives,
Initiative, yeah.
And which one particularly are you talking about?
The whole concept is completely flawed.
Because we've got hospitals built in the city under
schools,
PFI.
Yeah. But I mean, basically, if you were a councillor and you were looking at a dilapidated school and the central government said, well, you can have a new one through PFI and that's the only way you're allowed to do it, and then there's a considerable temptation for the council to say, yes, I think we'll have the new school, thanks very much. But the problem is that 30 years down the line, you're still paying for it, whether it's used or empty or not.
Martin, what's your view on the whole private finance initiative? Because it's enabled schools and hospitals, as Gary was saying, there to be built, but otherwise they would be dilapidated.
I mean, I obviously agree with Gary about this. The PFI has been a disaster. I mean, think about the Jubilee line in London.
Well, what happened there then?
Well, it was done through private finance initiative. You remember Gordon Brown forced this through against in the teeth of the opposition from Ken Livingstone. They forced PFI onto the London government, and of course it then went bust, costing the taxpayer millions. It's a sad story. And I hope that the new government is going to look very carefully at PFI and decide whether it's a serious runner or not. Because in many respects, what's really pernicious about it, a lot of these deals are secret deals. they are commercial confidentiality. So we're committing millions and billions of taxpayers' money to deals which we don't even know what the deals are because it's commercially confidential. It's outrageous.
So Gary, how happy are you or how nervous are you about the deal that's been done between your party and the Conservatives at Westminster?
Well, it's not ideal. But then again, you know, we wouldn't have started from here, would we?
Do you think that your party's being able and Nick Clegg's being able to twist Mr Cameron's arm enough?
I think there's very significant signs that things are different under a coalition than they would have been under a Conservative government. I mean, you know, you take the examples of, well, one of the priorities was actually going to be tax cuts for inheritance tax for millionaires, wasn't it, with the Conservatives? That sort of thing has disappeared out the window. What we've got instead is, in actual fact, in terms of spending on reducing taxes, is improving basic allowances so that people on low income don't pay so much tax. That's an indication of a change in something that the Conservatives would have done. Now, obviously, on a number of things, we're going to be holding our nose and saying we don't want to do this. But let's face it, as the Labour Party admitted, all the money had actually been spent. It was a disastrous situation. It had to be dealt with. And, you know, we're actually, I believe, going to a national government be able to mean that there's going to be some degree of confidence. One of the things is that I think that David Cameron was in actual fact frightened of his extreme right wing. And I think that we've actually provided some kind of counterbalance to that to prevent some of the more lunatic things actually being forced upon the Conservatives. They also were in a position where they would not have had, whatever measures they took, the backing of the majority of the people in Britain. And when you're facing a huge financial crisis, you certainly have got to get the majority of the people behind you.
Yes, but do you think you're going to suffer at the polls? Because you know, your party was saying, well, we don't need to cut yet. We need to make sure that the recovery is on a sound footing before we do the cuts. And now, of course, the reverse has happened.
Well, we've had to adjust things. We're in a coalition. As in a marriage, you don't get everything that you want.
Okay. Now, the Lord Chancellor, Kenneth Clarke, has finally sacked last week the Avon coroner, Paul Forrest. But what is a coroner? Journalist Dominic Harris explained it concisely last week in the Western Daily Press. He said, and I quote, "Coroners are senior lawyers or doctors, frequently both, who are in charge of holding formal inquests into people's deaths, where a cause needs to be found. They are one of the most ancient and senior positions in English law, first established more than 800 years ago, shortly after the Norman Conquest, in a bid to deter communities from a continuing habit of killing Normans. A heavy fine was levied on villages where a dead body was discovered on the assumption that it was a Norman, unless it could be proved to be a Saxon or English. The fine was known as the murdrum, from which the word murder is derived." Now, we'll be hearing from Andrew Gregg, Paul Forrest's lawyer, in a moment. But first, Gary, why the Avon coroner? I thought Avon had been abolished.
Well, Avon, as an administrative unit, has. But there was a logic to Avon, even though a lot of people didn't actually love it as an institution, in that it was of a size that, for a service like this, was logical. And, you know, on all sorts of other things, like that's why we work with our surrounding authorities on transport matters, because a lot of the people who travel into Bristol come from those surrounding authorities, and it is sensible to have an administrative unit of that size. So in case of the Avon coroner, the other three authorities actually pay Bristol to run the service.
Okay, now, Andrew Gregg from Queen's Square law firm Gregg Latchams is Avon coroner Paul Forrest's lawyer. When I spoke to him earlier this week, he explained what the original complaint against Paul Forrest by Bristol City Council was all about.
I'm Andrew Gregg, senior partner of Gregg Latchams, past president of Bristol Law Society and solicitor representing Paul Forrest, coroner for the County of Avon.
How and why was Paul initially suspended back at the beginning of 2009?
Paul was suspended as a result of a complaint about his conduct and his attitude towards the Bristol City Council and certain other councillors and people in the Bristol City Council. And as a result, an inquiry was ordered to be carried out by the Lord Chancellor's department, and Judge Rhesius carried out that inquiry, gathered evidence, and made a recommendation, which recommended that Mr. Forrest be dismissed from the office of coroner.
Now, it does sound a bit strange that a complaint should be made about his attitude. Why was his attitude seen to be potentially detrimental?
There were a number of issues involving the independence of the Office of Coroner. The first issue that arose resulted from the wholly inadequate facilities that existed at Backfields, the original coroner's court. As a result, there was a mega row between the coroner and Bristol City Council and the other unitary authorities as to what should happen about Backfields. For example, there were a number of other proposed sites for the coroner's court and mortuary, some of which were politically motivated, like, for example, some councillors wanted it up at Redfield and other places, purely from the point of view of it being politically convenient. So that was the first issue. Paul Forrest found that there was the old magistrate's court at Flaxbourton available. He arranged for a grant to be obtained to cover half the cost of that, and he went ahead and also then arranged for an architect who specialises in mortuaries and coroner's courts, called Mr. Venners, to prepare a feasibility study. That went ahead, and as a result, we now have the excellent and probably state-of-the-art best facilities for a coroner's court and a mortuary in the country.
So, Gary, why the complaint in the first place? It sounds to me like the coroner was just doing his job, trying to find and set up a new coroner's court because the old one just wasn't adequate.
There had been quite a number of other matters of contention between the coroner and various officials from various places, including obviously officials from the city council. There had been a complaint and a large number of complaints logged which aren't actually spoken of there, and it is the case that the ex-coroner was also sitting as a judge elsewhere. It became an impossible position for the service to be provided efficiently, because yes, we had a wonderful building that was put up, but when the auditors wanted to check what was actually going on, they were denied access to find out what was happening with the money. And also we had a considerable problem, or officers had a considerable problem with regard to providing the service because of lack of communication and being able to work with the officials from the city council responsible for providing the service.
Now, in British law, coroners are supposed to be independent of local authorities, and the trouble started where while after Bristol City Council took over the payroll system for the coroner's staff.
The other areas of complaint were, first of all, with regard to the coroner's staff, i.e. who was employing them. Because the Bristol City Council purported to, and indeed appear to have taken over the employment of the coroner's staff, and in particular the coroner's officers and administrators. Now, that involved difficult legislation, the transfer of undertakings legislation, TUPE. The coroner was very keen that the staff, and indeed the staff were keen, that they should remain under his control. They are, after all, his officers and his staff. So that was one big issue, which rumbles on. Who employs the coroner's staff and the coroner's officers?
Now, as I understand it, the coroner should be independent of the city council, and the city council should be paying the coroner's staff. So why did the city council decide that it should also be actually their employers? So with the power to hire and fire and sack those staff?
Indeed, that is correct, and that is what they have done with regard to one of the coroner's officers or staff now, Miss Vivian Edwards. They have, as I understand it, dismissed her. For what reason, I know not. It should not be a matter for the Bristol City Council. Whilst the City Council should obviously be advised as to who is employed, how much they're paid, what their duties are, and so on and so forth, because their primary duty is to fund the employee and to fund the expenses and outgoings for the coroner. The coroner, however, is and should be totally and utterly independent of any interference by the Bristol City Council or indeed any other local authority, and should be able to carry out his duties without constraint and be able to rely on the Bristol City Council and the other authorities to fund his coronial services.
Now, Gary, do you agree with this whole principle that the coroner should be independent?
I think in every system where there are people who are there to serve the public, there have to be checks and balances. In actual fact, the control here actually was central, and investigations were actually carried out by the Office of Judicial Complaint. They actually looked into this. They appointed a Crown Court judge who investigated the matter and gave a very clear view of where fault actually lay. And following that, there was a 5-day hearing with four specific experts involved, including specialists in HR law and again a judge. And this panel then actually produced a very clear report as to where they thought that fault actually lay. And in actual fact, therefore, said that the coroner should be dismissed. So that is not a decision of the Bristol City Council. That's a decision on people appointed by the Office of Judicial Complaint. He was also removed, as I understand it, as a judge from immigration, as an immigration judge at the same time. There were comments made as to his behaviour, which I think resulted in the dismissal.
Now, I asked Andrew Gregg, who's Paul Forrest's solicitor, whether it really matters whether the coroner is controlled or paid by the Bristol City Council or not. Now, why is it, do you think, that the Office of Coroner has been historically independent of the City Council, and the Council are supposed to pay the wages of the coroner and his staff, but he himself has independence? Why is that?
Well, the reason is simply this. You need to look right back at the history of the coroner's service. And the duty of the coroner, when carrying out his job, is to establish who the deceased was, where they died, when they died, and the cause of death, and to come up with answers to those basic questions. If you have anyone interfering in that function, and it could be the City Council, it could be a court, it could be anyone else, then you will not arrive at, possibly, a true verdict as to why that somebody died, where they died, and how they died, and what the cause of death was. The coroner needs to be totally and wholly independent.
Do you think that what's happened in this case does bring into question the independence of the coroner's service in the city?
I think it does. I think there's a great danger that it does. And if the City Council are allowed to interfere with the coronial duties, I think it could be a very, very serious inroad into the vital independence of a coroner.
Surely it's not going to go to the extent of actually affecting verdicts.
Well, it could do if, for example, the Bristol City Council were to control the coroner's officers, either financially by their salaries or by issuing directions and saying, well, you're employed by us, therefore you will do this, this and this, and if you fail to do so, you'll be in breach of your duty, etc., etc., then there is influence being put upon the coroner's staff, whose duty it is to investigate matters under the instruction of the coroner.
Now, this investigation was undertaken by something called the Office for Judicial Complaints. Can you tell us who they are and who actually conducted the review?
What happened is, following the finding of Judge Resius, that finding was challenged by the coroner by way of what's known as a judicial review. That's to say, an application to the administrative court to review the findings of the judge who carried out that original inquiry. What then happened is that the administrative court suggested and indeed offered that the Office of Judicial Complaints should look into the matter as a preliminary sort of issue and decide whether Judge Rhesius's findings were correct and to be upheld as a precursor to a full judicial review. What then happened is they referred the matter to the Office of Judicial Complaints, which set up a tribunal to look into it and heard evidence. They have then come up with their findings, which basically supported those of Judge Rhesius. The only problem is that they failed, when coming up with their findings, to comply with the rules and regulations and give the coroner and his legal advisers the right and the ability to question what findings they came up with. And that's a matter with which I am in correspondence. And basically I've said to them, why have you ignored these rules?
Now, Gary, what he's saying there is that actually making this announcement, the coroner's been dismissed, that Kenneth Clark and the Office of Judicial Complaints are actually circumscribing their own rules. Is that just sour grapes, or do you think that there's some strength to that argument?
I'm not a lawyer and therefore not qualified to answer that. All I can say is that the decision was taken by the government and Ken Clark after a High Court judge exactly looked at the matter and a tribunal from the Office of Judicial Complaint. It is not up to me to second guess what they've actually done.
Well, I did ask him. I said, but what is it that you're complaining about here? The most contentious part of the latest decision is whether or not the Lord Chancellor and the Office of Judicial Complaints have actually followed their own rules. And this is what Andrew Gregg, solicitor for Paul Forrest, the ex-coroner of Avon, had to say.
Well, why on earth should they be ignoring their own rules?
Very good question. Would you like to put that to them? And would you also ask them, please, to respond to my questions as to why they have done so? I wish they would abide by the rules.
Now, they've also failed to respond to my questions as well. As this is a sensitive office, the Office for Judicial Complaints, do you think that there really needs to be a little bit more public accountability with decisions being very, very clear who has made decisions, how, and exactly what they've based those decisions on?
That's exactly what the rules and regulations say, in that when they publish a decision, they are supposed to abide by a timetable and enable people to comment on it.
And have they not done that in this case?
No, they haven't. And that is something with which I am deeply concerned as to why they haven't done it. The regulations are the Judicial Discipline (brackets prescribed procedures) regulations of 2006, and it first of all requires a review body to send a copy of the final report to Mr. Forrest. Well, I say they haven't done that. Eventually I received it. Secondly, it requires the Lord Chancellor and Lord Chief Justice, after considering the report, to set out the proposed action, i.e. to set it out. They haven't done that. Regulation 27.1, they should notify Mr. Forrest of the proposal and invite him to make representations. They haven't done that. Regulation 27.2, Mr. Forrest or the coroner should make any representations within 20 business days. Well, when he hasn't received the proposal, we're still waiting to do that. Finally, under Regulation 27.3, only after considering such representations can the Lord Chancellor and the Lord Chief Justice make a decision. Now, it seems to me that they have made a decision with a total disregard to the regulations, and the coroner should seriously consider judicial review proceedings against them now.
Anyway, the coroner has vowed to fight on, apparently to clear his name, and is challenging the Office for Judicial Complaints ruling as unlawful. So this may not be the last we hear of this. Anyway, it's 5:30. Actually, no, it's nearly 5:40, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Gary Hopkins' choice of music. Gary, what's the song, and why did you choose it?
Don't You Forget About Me by Simple Minds, and came from a very entertaining film some years ago, The Breakfast Club.
your troubles and doubts, giving me everything inside and out. And love's strange, so real in the dark. Think of the tender things that we were working on. Slow change may pull us apart. When the light gets in your heart, baby, don't you forget about me. Don't you forget about me. Will you stand above me? Look my way, never love me. Rain keeps falling, rain keeps falling down, down, down. Will you recognize me? Call my name or walk on by. Rain keeps falling, rain keeps falling down. Your defenses, vanity, insecurity. Don't you forget about me. I'll be alone, dancing, you know it, baby. Going to take you apart. I'll put us back together at heart, baby. Don't you forget about me.
Don't you forget about me. The Simple Minds there, chosen by today's guest, Gary Hopkins, who's Lib Dem councillor for Knowle. Now, back to our review of this week's news, and joining me in the studio is Marina Morris with a report, guess what, on crime.
Hello. According to the Home Office Statistical Bulletin update on crime to December 2009, the overall level of reported crime in that year has fallen by 7% compared to the 2008 year. The risk of being a victim of crime decreased from 23% to 22%. Violent crime appears to have remained approximately static, although due to reclarification of offences is not directly comparable, while most other types of crime fell. The greatest drop of 21% being in theft from the person, although the 2008 total appears abnormally high, reversing a 25% increase the previous year. Only sexual offences and the theft of the bicycles showed an increase. Statistics published from the Avon and Somerset Police Force demonstrate a similar downward trend sustained over a longer period. Comparing the incidence of reported crime per 1,000 head of the population between 2005-06 and 2008-09, the incidence of 9 categories of offences has fallen, some quite significantly. Fraud and forgery dropped from nearly 5 to just about 3, a fall of 37%. Only drug offences have increased from about 3 to 3.5 over this period. The rates of conviction are difficult to source and dangerous to interpret. However, according to Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary's 2005 inspection report of Avon and Somerset Police, conviction rates in 2003-04 and 2004-05 were 15.8% and 17.1%, ranking 40th out of 42 areas. Conviction rates can, however, be misleading. National statistics show that only about 6% of rape cases result in a conviction, a statistic which hardly encourages the reporting of such crime. The statistic masks the fact that 60% of cases that reach a court result in a conviction. Nationally, according to the provisional quarterly criminal justice system performance indicators of the 4.72 million reported crimes in 2009, 1.29 million offenses were brought before the court. The payment rate for fines was 82%. The Bristol area has four prisons in the immediate area. HMP Bristol housing 614 male prisoners from remand to category B. HMP Eastwood Park housing up to 362 women of all categories, including a mother and a baby unit. HMP Lakehill housing 512 male prisoners in open conditions. And HMP Ashfield, a private prison holding approximately 400 male juveniles between the age 15 and 18. Bristol prison population is approaching a maximum of 2,000 of England's and Wales's approximately 85,000 prisoners, more than 80,000 of whom are male.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Gary, let's start with that last thing there, which is the private prison, HMP Ashfield. It's apparently just for male juveniles, 400 of them. How do you think this whole thing of private prisons has been working out? Any idea?
It's got to be very concerning. Unfortunately, the prison system in general in this country is massively overcrowded, mainly because a lot of short-term prisoners who shouldn't be in there are in prison, and because of the overcrowding, because of the conditions, there's been very, very little effective treatment and assistance given to prisoners, and that's why the reconviction rates and the reoffending rates are so high in this country compared to most other comparable countries.
Now, we do seem to score quite well in Avon and Somerset on some of the general ways that the police is examined, but one of the things we're not good at is drug offences, which have been going up. Why is that, do you think?
Well, in terms of drug offences, we actually, in Avon and, well, in Bristol in particular, because the biggest problem is in Bristol rather than Avon and Somerset in general, there was a huge spike 10, 12 years ago in illegal drug use and import, and it was allowed to get completely out of control. And the knock-on effect of crime over years, it just doesn't disappear in a year or two, because a high percentage of people, once they become illegal drug users, commit huge numbers of crimes to pay for their habits. And really, you know, although crime in Bristol is still above the national average, it is actually reducing quicker now than it is elsewhere. So, you know, from a bad start a number of years ago, I think things are getting better.
Okay, and our conviction rates were 15.8%, which is 40th out of 42 areas. Now, that's also really quite low. So
I think you'll find that's from a few years ago.
Okay, from 2005. Now, that's... Yeah. So you think things are getting better, are they?
Conviction rates now are around about 25, 26% in actual fact, which is roundabout average. But conviction rates don't tell you everything. They are an important measure, but it's the total level of crime that's important, but also the way, how safe people actually feel, because... it's all very well saying, well, burglaries are down, but if people are frightened to go out at night, then we haven't really done our job, have we?
Martin, what are your thoughts on this, particularly this the drug offences, which are the only offence to have increased from 3 to 3.5?
I mean, I've made this kind of comment before on this show, as you know. We've got to start thinking about legalisation of drugs. Senior politicians in Latin America, including Cardoso, used to be the president of Brazil, and various other people, put together a report pointing out that if we don't legalise and regulate this industry, which is a huge industry, probably bigger than the car industry, we're going to have a huge knock-on effects in terms of crime, as Gary was saying, people stealing for their habits and all the rest of it.
So kids buy heroin from Tesco?
No, I'm not suggesting that for a moment. I mean, Danny Kushlick, who heads up Transform, which is based in Eastern, is an NGO which is campaigning on this issue. And if you think back to the 1920s in the United States, when alcohol was illegal, that's when organized crime got a grip on US life and politics, which it's never really let go of. And we've now got a multi-million dollar drug industry. Wally Karzai, who is the brother of Hamid Karzai, who is our ally in Afghanistan, named by the police of the world as a major drug dealer in Afghanistan, he's on the CIA payroll. Now, this is the kind of mess that we're getting into. During the 80s, when we were fighting the Russians in Afghanistan, the Mujahideen, who were actually armed and trained by the Western intelligence services, were funding what they were doing with heroin. The knock-on effects were seen on the streets of Bristol, and those were our allies fighting the Russians in Afghanistan. Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is now our enemy, was our ally at that time, and it was all funded with heroin. It's well known. Everybody in Pakistan knows this, that the state is implicated in drug dealing. Everybody in Colombia knows this. The right-wing death squads, which are aligned with the United States, funded with cocaine. The Iran-Contra affair in the 80s funded with cocaine. Now, we've got to start talking seriously about this and recognise that we can't go on as we have been doing.
But Gary, one of the big concerns has got to be, you know, what with the recession and more unemployment, I mean, isn't this going to mean that that there is going to be more problems with drugs in the city? People basically with nothing to do.
Well, there was a serious concern that as soon as the recession started, crime would start to rocket upwards. Actually, it didn't, which is an encouraging sign. And I think that what we need to, you need to look at when you look at drugs, they're not just a crime problem, they're also a serious health problem. And, you know, lots of drugs are a serious problem to those who use them. And, you know, legalization does not address the problem of people who take drugs thinking there'll be some fun and then find themselves completely hooked. I mean, it isn't just that they go out and commit crimes to feed the habit, dangerous and damaging though that is, they're also damaging themselves and people round about them.
Well, I agree, it's very much a health issue, but I mean, alcohol is also a health issue. Alcohol is legal, even though it's not very good for you, but, and so is tobacco.
But it's much more than that as well, isn't it? I mean, we've heard last night there was a murder in Stapleton Road. 8 people have now, apparently, we've heard just today, been arrested after a 19-year-old man was stabbed to death in a street in Bristol. This incident happened in Stapleton Road, the junction with Villiers Road in Easton, shortly after 11 p.m. on Thursday. Now, anyone that knows that area will know that there is sort of actually open drug dealing going on in the street there.
You can't presume that that's anything to do with this particular
it
incident.
It might have nothing to do with this at all.
It's one of those sort of no-go zones, isn't it?
Well, no. It might, in actual fact, be a family dispute. It could be any sort of problem. Yeah. You've got no indication at all that that is linked to drugs. It may be, but we don't know.
If it's in the same area as there's open drug dealing going on the pavement.
Yeah, but Tony, you can't presume that this particular incident which happened last night has anything to do with drugs at all. Why presume that? It might be, it might not be. I mean, the issue about I'm talking about legalisation, I'm not talking about buying it in Tesco's. Until 1968 in Britain, if you were a heroin addict, you could go to the doctor and get heroin. And you didn't have to go and steal or deal or do anything. You just went to the doctor and you got your heroin. Now, I'm talking about having a rational approach to what we're doing, recognising that there are lots of people out there taking drugs and they're going to do it one way or another. Now, we've got to find a way to get to grips with this. And the health messages about this isn't good for you have got to be very much part of that. But we've also got to face reality, because what's happening in many countries like Colombia is that the corruption of the drugs trade is destroying social life completely. I mean, it's the killings that go with it, not so much the health issues. We're talking about people being murdered all the time about money to do with an illegal market which we're not regulating. Now, we've got to start facing up to this.
So let's just forget the murder last night for a moment. And this whole concept of open dealing going on the streets, is there no way that the police can deal with this?
Well, in actual fact, I think that's an exaggeration to say that there's complete open dealing going on.
I've driven past there and seen people exchanging.
This is just anecdotes, Tony, anecdotes.
I'm afraid you're exaggerating the problem. There is dealing with patently and obviously in all sorts of areas that goes on within Bristol. The police, where they have the evidence, will act.
Okay. Martin, you were going to say something?
No, I'm just going to say the police obviously have priorities, and their priority is violent crime, not busting people smoking some weed in a back garden, you know. Get serious.
Well, it may be crack cocaine or heroin rather than weed.
We've got to have some sense of what are serious crimes that the police need to concentrate on. I mean, killing people, violence, those are the serious crimes.
And we've also had an anti-terror raid this week. The anti-terror police have arrested a man in Bristol city centre flat. He's in custody now, apparently. A second address in the city was also searched as part of the same operation, but the police refused to disclose its location. One brewhouse resident, which is where this original raid took place, who asked not to be named, said the noise at 6:45 a.m. woke him and his girlfriend. He said, "We were woken by shouting and banging that sounded like someone had dropped a box down the stairs. I looked out of my window into the corridor and saw a police officer with what looked like a gun in his hand. After a couple of minutes, the fire alarm went off and in the building after the police triggered what appeared to be flash bombs in this person's flat. I quickly got dressed and tried to get out, but the police shouted and said, 'This is not a fire alarm, a police incident. Go back to your flat.' The resident said he'd never seen the arrested man before. Since the arrest, the police have sealed the flat off, which is in George's Square opposite Castle Park, and are carrying out forensic searches." Well, this sounds like pretty scary stuff to have this kind of thing happening in the city, Gary.
Well, in actual fact, I think there was, although the police have to take precautions, he wasn't, as I understand it, from the Bristol area. Travelled into the area fairly recently. He wasn't a terrorist, and in actual fact, soon after, a Metropolitan Priest got hold of him and took him back to the station. He was de-arrested on terrorist offences, and then re-arrested on the grounds of actually a bomb hoax, which was apparently perpetrated against the Sun newspaper. He had a hoax bomb.
Probably our final story. Goldman Sachs gambling on starvation. This was from last week's independent newspaper. Now, apparently Goldman Sachs have actually been making lots of money out of people starving in the third world. Martin, this is one of your pet subjects, actually. Would you like to just comment on how on earth it can be that people can be starving because what's going on at investment banks? I would have thought that's just to do with whether they can grow food or not.
No, well, as we were talking earlier about the oil industry and the oil price being determined by futures markets, we've now got these speculative markets in everything, including food. So the speculators who are buying into grain mountains, futures contracts on grain, it was all deregulated in the year 2000. We've now got a situation where speculators are pushing up the price of food, which is actually forcing food out of the mouths of the hungry, and they're making money out of it. It was all regulated before, and they weren't able to do that. Now they can. Isn't the free market a wonderful thing?
The problem with this is, not just in this area, but in a number of others, that instruments, facilities that were brought in to try and reduce risk, hedging was originally brought in so that people could bet against big losses and therefore reduce their downside risks, have actually been switched round now to ramp up risk dramatically.
Yeah.
And the market was actually been allowed, when things were allowed to happen in this country and the financial markets in this country, that even the United States actually banned.
That's right.
Things like what's called naked short selling, where basically pure gambling rather than in actual fact sensible management of the economy and to manage risk for the future.
So is your coalition government going to sort this all out now?
Well, yes, in actual fact, early stages of better regulation. I think the person who was warning about a lot of this stuff, the earliest of serious politicians, was Vince Cable, and he is in there in the government and is having influence. How it actually comes out at the end of the day, we'll see. But certainly the earliest warnings from serious politicians certainly came from Vince.
But it does look like, certainly the Conservative Party are really reluctant to rein in the city because they see the city is really the source of the country's wealth, and many of their decisions are simply based on how the markets are going to react. They are quite beholden to the markets, aren't they?
Well, it depends what you're looking at. I mean, it's certainly the case that we have to get our financial borrowing under control, because if we don't, we will be in a mess. And it's not a progressive government that starts stealing money from its children and grandchildren, which is basically what the previous government were actually doing. That is not a way forward. Having said that, you are in a position where if your basics are sensible and under control, if you're somewhere where you're not over borrowing at the wrong time, then you can act more fairly.
Martin?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think what really worries me is that I don't see that cutting public expenditure at this moment in the economic cycle makes any sense at all. I mean, Vince Cable the other day was saying we've got to rebalance the economy towards the private sector. I think we're actually in a new situation after the collapse of the banks. We've had a dominant private sector for a whole generation since 1979. We're going to have to go back to having a dominant public sector, which means public sector investment and taxes on the wealthy. If there's a hole in the finances, cutting down people's consumption will crash the economy. This very, very dangerous moment, frankly.
Well, we're coming up to the Sky News at 6. Thanks to this week's guest, Liberal Democrat Councillor for Knowle and Cabinet Member for Community Safety, Gary Hopkins, after the news. This week has seen the fifth anniversary of the so-called 7/7 London bombings back in 2005. Well, we did our own 7/7 inquiry last week, and this week we focus on the precursor to that in the War on Terror, the 9/11 attacks on New York. Joining us here in the studio is coffee importer and author Ian Henshaw, who's written one of the UK's definitive books on the attacks entitled 9/11, The New Evidence. Join us after the news.
FM, it is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.